Arabella Francesca, the average lunch in the Cortile and Urbino, and therefore he found out that there was a strange thing happening at the corner. I don't want that as a paper or as a pricey. I want a terse, no rhetoric discourse on critical elements of a building. I don't think I can be any more specific. If you think that Bob Stern's apartment building in New York has critical element in it, go ahead and try. That's one I wouldn't suggest.
Does the building have to be built?
No. No, the building does not have to have been built. But there should be enough information that you can ascertain the critical elements of the building. Anything else?
I heard the annotated bibliography is a normal sort of annotated bibliography.
Did I say I wanted an annotated bibliography? No, I purposely said I don't want a damn bibliography, because that you just take a page and, you know, and write down the books. I don't want to know that. Well, you can make references if you want, but that's an extra page. If you think I'm going to check your references, you're nuts. I have enough trouble reading 49, 7-page, awfully written papers, all right? I mean, that is the most turgid thing I look forward to at Christmas. I can believe me. Just think what it must be like and how you're going to make an impression when you hand in your paper, right? I mean, just try and understand what that might be like, right? Because the turgidity of, you know, and repetitiveness and the misspell words, the misplaced commas and punctuation, the poor grammar, I mean, is enough to drive one insane, all right? And I think there should be a literacy test before getting into Yale. That would be my first test. Because it's an important facet. Now, I have noticed a mistake, and I will ask Tate will be able to find this out. The Witkover, Carlo Rinaldi and the Roman Architecture, the full Baroque, which is really an important piece, is not listed that it's in the Journal of the Warburg and Courtauld Institute, according to my bibliography. It was left off. Now, I don't know if we have it or not. That's a key text for next week.
Okay.
All right. So I don't know if they have that in their packets.
Yeah, I'll look.
Okay. Would anybody know?
Does anyone have their packets?
I believe we do.
Pardon?
I believe we do.
You do? Okay, well, if you don't, you've got to find out. It's 1935, Journal of the Warburg and Courtauld. That's an important text. A sequel text is Witkover's text on the Laurentian Library by Michelangelo, and that's not in it either. I mean, they may want to look at that for whatever reason to add to their, but I mean, if you check that out, okay, because they're a pair of articles that Witkover wrote in 35. Next week, the only way that you can do next week's assignment, that is a critical analysis between the two churches at the Piazza del Popolo, is to read the Witkover article, because he's the only person that talks about the difference between Bernini's church and Rinaldi's church. And of course, to me, they are that difference is really important. And of course, when you go to Rome and you go to the Piazza del Popolo and you go to these two churches, it's really important to understand the architectural implications of the church in the cityscape and the church interior, and what is the difference between the two. And so you're going to have to read a text and look at these two churches and the drawings, and then have to make drawings that describe what the critical difference is between those two churches. And once you know how to do that, tourists go into the Piazza del Popolo all the time. They may go into those churches, although I doubt very much if many tourists do. But what's interesting is it requires an enormous amount of sensitivity of seeing, trained seeing, to understand conceptually the difference between the one church and the other church. And Witkover's analysis is stunning in that respect. And so I think it's important to understand how those churches work in the urban fabric and then what the differences are. So that's why it's important that they, if they don't have that text, they're just not going to be able to do it. And of course, I will be able to tell clearly whether you have in fact read that text. Any other questions or? Yeah.
On the Witkover reading this week, it draws a lot from primary sources in Italian, and there are no Bibles translating them. So I just suggest to you next year, find somebody to speak Italian, create those translations and put them in the readers. Because all of the crucial points are made in the language that both of us have to speak.
Wait a minute. Palladio on the Problem of Harmonic Proportions is in English.
Well, the paper is English, but there are all these quotations.
I've never read the damn quotations, by the way. But I mean, what are you, crazy?
Well, there are entire paragraphs that are...
You don't... Can I tell you what? Try and read over them. I mean, we're just trying to give a way into some of these ideas. What I'm trying to get you to do is to see and to think, not to worry about the Italian quotes. Okay? If they were important, they would have been translated. In other words, when you hear somebody speaking Slovenian in a movie and you don't see a footnote, you know it doesn't matter what's being said. I promise you, you'll get by this course. But if you know you'd like to make those translations or get somebody to do it, be my guest. You can call me. I'm very interested in misreading, not reading. In other words, I'm interested in how you interpret something from what you have, the visual evidence and the written evidence, not being a scholar, right? Because architects have to learn how to misread information. That's the only way you're going to create your own being, is by misreading somebody else. Misinterpretation. That's what all philosophers have done. That's what all scientists have done. In other words, they stumble upon something by misinterpreting something and find something. And so don't worry about the strict translations. We're not in catechism here. Okay? We're trying to open up your eyes, not hone down your minds. Okay? So I apologize if it is disturbing, but I should have given you that and said, don't worry about the quotations, right? But if you think that it's disturbing, I'll just erase the text. Because I'm not getting anybody to... Remember, these reading lists, I said it at the top. I don't want anybody at the end saying the reading lists are too long. I don't expect you to do the reading. This is the first text for next week that I've said you should read, right? Because you can't do the work. This is for whatever, your future. It's like a book of what I consider to be critical texts. For example, the Bruschi on Bramante. There's no better source than Bruschi on Bramante, and you don't have to read the whole damn book. All you have to do is read chapters 3, 5, and 9. I have read the book at one time or another, and as far as I'm concerned, it's not important to read practically any book. For example, my Bible, Jacques Derrida's Of Grammatology, I've only read the first 96 pages, are the only pages important to read. The next 300 pages are for pinhead scholars who are interested in Derridean lore. But for an architect to read the first 96 pages is enough. So remember that these readings mainly are for you to get a sort of sense of who the players are, where the material is, and not much more. You know, it's important to know who Witkover is. It's important to know who Brusky is. It's important to know who Colin Rowe is. It's important to know who Manfredo Tafuri is. So that's why certain of these texts are there. But as far as helping you to understand where this class is going, a lot of it is, you know, could be peripheral. Any other questions? So there are two missing?
Yes.
Two missing, okay. It's okay. All right. If one could say that the work of Brunelleschi and Alberti introduce a certain mechanism into the relationship between the subject and object. That is, to try and see architecture as a mechanism. That is, a mechanism that holds the possibility of understanding itself internal to its being. That is, through a perspectival relationship, in the case of Brunelleschi. In other words, deploying different spatial strategies, whether it's elongation or compression, they are done through a mechanism that is perspective, and they are calibrated, in a sense, in a mechanical way. Alberti also introduces perspectival concerns, but also enters into the history of the possibilities of these mechanisms. It is with Bramante, as I said last week, that we come to a zero position, because he moves from mechanism to organism. In other words, that this is not an external condition, either history or references externally or perspectival references, but spatial organization, that is, the organization of solid and void in relationship to one another, which brings Bramante to a point, a zero moment. Now, what you have to realize is that by 1520 in Rome, we've now had about 80 years of what one could call anthropocentrism. That is, the shift from a transcendental metaphysic to an immanent metaphysic. And for the first time, that immanent metaphysic becomes problematic. In other words, while one was trying to establish it in relationship to a transcendental metaphysic, by 1520, and certainly by 1527 and the sack of Rome, a whole new idea of how one thinks about architecture. It's often called mannerism, the period from 1527 to 1570. I don't like to use that word, because it means that the essential characteristics remain in place. I would rather suggest that the architecture that we're going to look at, whether it's Serlio, Peruzzi, Vignola, Scamozzi, Palladio, etc., are people who, in a sense, purposely misread classical canon and misread the perspectival ideas of Brunelleschi and Alberti misread the organizational elements of the classical organizational elements that Bramante is playing with to produce what I would call an anarchic architecture. And I can remember one of the important American architectural historians, Howard Burns, saying to me at Harvard in 1995, I guess, 10 years ago, I was teaching a studio on Serlio. And in other words, similar to this course, they would understand and draw the critical elements of Serlio, and using those critical strategies produce designs a la Serlio, not looking like Serlio, but using the tropes, the strategies that Serlio used. And Howard Burns said to me, you know, Peter, Serlio's not an architect. And I realized then how important it was that Howard Burns was an architectural historian and that I was an architect, because Howard couldn't see anything off the straight and narrow. In other words, it had to be according to classical canon or deviation from classical canon, but it couldn't be anything other. What we're going to see today, and when we look at Serlio, is a person of enormous virtuosity. I think he only built one or maybe two buildings in France, but unimportant buildings. But a person whose books, and again, the book becomes very important, especially Serlio's sixth book and seventh book, which define a whole range of theoretical or virtual buildings. In other words, plans for buildings that were never built, probably never could be built, but plans which begin to suggest a way of taking Brunelleschi, Bramante, Alberti, and misreading what they had put forward. I mean, misreading their attempt at either mechanism or organism, because now we are no longer in an organism, but we're in something else, because what's happened is that the forms, instead of just expressing a relationship between solid and void, begin to express another series of problems. And so what we're going to do is to look at Serlio, because I think he is a treasure trove of how one can make new things from old rules, that is, by misinterpreting old rules and producing what one would call strangeness. And Serlio started, again, like Giulio Romano, who is also one of the more famous of these architects. In other words, if you ever have a chance to go to Mantua, in addition to looking at Alberti's three churches, there is Giulio Romano's Palazzo del Te, which is probably one of the seminal pieces of misreading architecture. And so you look at Alberti to get the canon that was being established at the time, and you look at Giulio Romano for, in a sense, the dissolution of that canon. And of course, would I like to take a week with all of you, and we go to the Veneto, we go to Mantua, we see the Palladian villas, see the churches, go to Rome, see Piranesi, would be an amazing experience for you all to see this stuff in the flesh. Because one thing is to look at pictures, one thing is to read about it, one thing is to draw it, another thing is to go and see it. And of course, it adds to one's understanding. Now, what's interesting about Serlio, there ain't anything to see. You get it all in the book. And that's why he's very important to students, because his book is a kind of encyclopedia of how to redirect energy. In other words, if one were to say that modern architecture existed at a certain moment, a high modern architecture that was, let's say, Le Corbusier and Mies van der Rohe, you could also say that Frank Gehry and Rem Koolhaas redirected modern architecture in a way, not to look like Serlio, but understanding the principles of redirection, misreading, transformation, etc., to produce another kind of architecture. And it's going to be necessary for you all not to merely know what Corbu and Mies did, so you understand what Koolhaas and Gehry did, but how to redirect Koolhaas and Gehry. Because that's, otherwise you suffocate in their wake. So my feeling is this whole course is about the ways that architects, as it were, got out of other people's direction. And of course, the great person for that discourse is at Yale, Harold Bloom, who wrote a map of misreading and talked about the idea, the literary and philosophical idea of swerving. And any of you Yale undergraduates who were Yale undergraduates took Bloom, you realize that the really enormous impact that his work had on contemporary literary thought, a really important book. And of course, one could, in fact, write a book, Map of Misreading Architecture, of which this course would be a kind of prolegomena. It seems to me that the only way that you can learn how to misread is first learn how to read, and that's what we're learning, and by reading I mean seeing, and understand seeing of misreading. In other words, what we're doing is training you how to really see correctly, but see things that were in themselves misreadings. And then what you'll be able to do, you'll understand what misreading is, you'll understand then how you can use the seeing that you understand as direct seeing to learn how to misdirect, transform, swerve from that manner of seeing. And those are the three things. First, you learn how to see. Then you learn how to see things that are in themselves misreadings. And then you learn how to misread what you've learned how to see in order to clear for yourself a situation. And so this whole class is a build-up of a strategy to define how it is that one understands what normalcy is at any moment in time and how one moves from that normalcy toward the possibility of misreading, and then how does one make that misreading conceptually into some physical three-dimensional artifact. So we are now, for the first time, looking at intentional misreadings. Okay? In other words, in a sense, a misappropriation of what went before, purposefully done. So for me, that isn't a manner, a manière of what went before. That is a really deep problem with what went before, and therefore does not use what went before as a continual base to see something that keeps it in place but is only a manner of it. This is a radical transformation of what went before. So this begins approximately at the time of the sack of Rome, and clearly the sack of Rome in 1527 is a paradigmatic shift in consciousness. It was the first time that Rome had been overrun since the Middle Ages, and a whole new idea of what the city needed to be like, how the city needed to make connections, how one organized the city from a medieval city to a quote-unquote modern city, took place after 1527. So the whole idea of the new Rome was attached to this idea coming from the sack of Rome in 1527. And what you'll see in the Piazza del Popolo, which was one of the trident, which was put into Rome about this time, these two churches, the trident of streets, the Corso coming from the Piazza del Popolo, and these two churches then framing between the streets, become really important elements in how Rome is to be understood. And what's interesting about the two churches, they propose two different strategies for how Rome is to be understood. Standing on the same piazza, flanking one another, supposedly symmetrical artifacts, and for the tourists they are symmetrical artifacts, only they ain't. And it's the critical difference between what appears to be a bilateral symmetry and what really exists that is what is interesting to know. And it begins to show you how a building or a series of buildings can begin to reflect a new organization of urban fabric. And ultimately, that's, you know, when you get to third year and beyond here, you will start to deal with projects that deal with the fabric of the city. Okie dokie, let's go. Let's look at some pics. Now, don't ask me what the names of these things are, because I don't know and I don't care. And you don't need to know and you don't need to care. All you need to know is that they were drawn by Serlio and they are in his book. This is the Pantheon. These are various drawings of temple-like structures that Serlio found in history. You have to notice the relationship of this and this to Bramante's Tempietto, which I think is very important, the Pantheon. And what we're going to see when we look at the two churches, we're going to see a relationship of Redentore and San Giorgio to the Pantheon. On the right, we start to see Serlio playing with centrally organized churches or structures of some sort that begin to play in a different way. And let's look at this sort of spidery poche here, which in one sense comes from Bramante. It's very similar to either, I think it's St. Peter's 3 or 2, but in any case, if you look at the way the external indentations become as important, let's say, almost as the interior, but look, the interior ones are these ovate-shaped forms with rounded ends, which again are different from what you see on the exterior. So there is a dislocation in this edge between the exterior, which is a circle, the interior structure, which appears either almost circular or almost octagonal. It's not clear because of the way the poche works, and especially at the points where the octagon would be articulated, that is, at the joining points, there is a poche void. And these are the little things to look at, so that when you squint, you're not looking at a circle in here and you're not looking at an octagon. You're looking at something between the two because of these little niches here, which articulate at the point where you need a point, they give you a void. And this is one of the strategies of dealing with the organism that begins to blur the condition. In other words, you're not just looking at a single unit as you are here. There's no question that the inside and the outside have some relationship to this interior organization, that this exterior and this interior are the same, that while there's a Willy Wonka shape here, the interior and exterior practically define the exterior. But suddenly you begin to see differentiation occurring in very strange, you know, a pentagonal plan here with a circle in the center and these sort of slices of a pie-shaped organization that give you sort of dominant pieces and then interstitial pieces in order to give you the poche structure. And you notice in all of these conditions something that here, this sort of rectilinear with apsoidal ends, niches in the poche, and then an octagonal center with a square in the center and a rectangle in the square. And that's these thematics of like Russian dolls sort of moving out from a center where there's no consistency necessarily between the center and the edge. And then you get something like the strangest of these pieces clearly is this piece where the four ordinal axes are defined by almost circles, but circles that have also another protrusion here, another abscended protrusion, so that there are no clear forms. They're all always obscured by other forms that, or pieces of space that are formed that attach to them that interrupt the purity of the form. And so it's really important to understand that the disruption of the purity of the form is the idea, that one is not supposed to see an organism that is a whole thing, but at each different scale, another organism occurring that may not relate to the first one. So unlike a Russian doll, which is a bigger or a smaller and smaller indication of the same figure, here the pieces are stacked in a very different way. And of course, this is an architectural idea. You have a container that may be a square. You put inside it a circle, you put inside that an octagon, and you begin to get the devolution toward a center of a very strange series of objects. And, you know, it works today. And we could analyze some of modern architects' favorite pieces to begin to see similar kinds of strategies in use. Next, please. Here we begin to see, again, Serlio's favorite motif is the sort of centralized organism that then is broken down into subsets. And of course, what's interesting here is that these circular pieces are pressed into the fabric, the square fabric, so that you don't get them as complete. They're not articulated. And of course, modern architecture, especially somebody like Marcel Breuer and Walter Gropius in their binuclear houses that they made so popular, articulated the public wing from the private wing with a connective tissue, a passage that connected objects. And when I was going to school, the whole idea of the articulating the connective was important. Here, the connective tissue is blurred because these things are pushed into the fabric of the building. And you notice the square spaces at the corners, the articulated round pieces, and it's a plan that has an enormous virtuosity. And of course, if you look at the pieces of the niches that are in the corners, they're asymmetrically placed to give a diagonal thrust. So there is a diagonal thrust to the niches that are placed in these rooms. And then you get these diagonal pieces that in a sense frame and are seem to have been kicked off by the imposition. If you read this particular rotunda as being pushed into this fabric, then you get the sense that this has been pushing this void off of its rectangular or orthogonal move. And so when you read this, and this is the critical condition here, when you read this diagonal, you say, why is that on a diagonal? Why is it like that? Then you begin to understand that this object has been pushed into here, that it's incomplete, only completes itself in here, and therefore pushes, there's a thrust of it off. So there's a compression on this space so that the relationship to this and this is made clear by this diagonal movement in the poche, the diagonal movement of this passage off of center. These are the kinds of things that I want you to look at. It's important to understand that what we're dealing with now is not something that is a static condition, but something that starts to have sort of energy. There's a certain energy to the positioning that they just don't remain stable, but they start to fluctuate and give a certain dynamism to what was, if one could say Bramante was a certain kind of static organic, this is a dynamic organism, let's say. In other words, organisms that in themselves are not complete, but suggest various modes of completion. Next, please. These are two of Serlio's villa plans, and the interesting thing is that all of these villas or palazzos have a similar kind of organization. The ideal organization of a palazzo is an entry loggia space, an A space, a B or transition space between the entry loggia and the central main space, which is here, which is always articulated with a figural poche in Palladio, in Serlio, in Giulio Romano. The central main space, even though it may not be bigger in size than the other spaces, is always articulated by a figural poche, as you can see here. So the poche becomes very important to the figuration. And then there is the second B space and the rear portico or loggia here, another A. So you get A, B, C, B, A as an ideal organization. But what's interesting about it and what Serlio does here, while this is moving from a symmetry to the rear and to the front, notice that. Look at what the side rooms do. They are a sequence of A, B, C. They are a progression. And he sets this up through a very clever articulation of the central spaces and the addition of these spaces here. So rather than a build up to the center, here we have an echelon of spaces that starts with large, medium, and small, which plays against the centralizing rhythm. So this is a central piece in an echelon. This is a fulcrum to an echelon, where this is a fulcrum to a symmetry. And that's really important, that the side pieces, because of the poche, are articulated differently than the front pieces. Now, one could argue, if we look at these two, which one of these is critical? Where is their critical content? This merely has A, B, C, and has a B which also subsumes a portico in the rear, so it's not quite an ideal situation. But the side rooms do not contain necessarily any idea that would, they just seem to be rooms, large one, medium, little, but they're not organized in a kind of echeloning geometry to play against this. So I would argue that this plan contains critical material that this plan doesn't. Doesn't mean that this plan is bad. It merely says it's more normal. It doesn't contain an idea, which this plan does, that the side rooms here are different than the side rooms over here and are organized in a palpable way that you would understand that progression. That's what I mean by critical content. All buildings will have plans. All buildings in the Renaissance had central spaces. All buildings had a kind of ABCBA ideality, that is a front-to-back symmetry. But very few of them have this condition on the side. So there is an example of two plans done by the same architect. Sure, this has some, you know, we could point to a lot of different ideas that occur here, but the main difference, conceptual difference, is the critical organization of the side rooms to play what I would call contrapuntally against the main axial rooms. And that's important to see. Next, please. Now, here we have one of Serlio's most famous plans, where we have now in the side rooms are also figural. That is, all of the rooms, instead of being, here we have our loggia, our gasket or interstitial space or circulation space, and we have our main space, which is a figural space, our rear gasket space, and our rear portico. But what's interesting is the organization of the side rooms. And I think that's, I mean, if you ever have a kind of Willy Wonka plan, it's this plan, where these small square rooms enter into octagonal shapes, confusing these shapes, where they begin to play with, you know, here are niches that are rectilinear, here's a niche that's been elongated and produces something else. The same with the situation over here. We have very strange fact that we have these kinds of stairway connections here, which strangely organize the plan. We have these bent hallways, as if this thing got, as you were walking back here, you get a little bending, and then suddenly, you know, and this doesn't have to be that way, but it shows you that in fact there's a kind of dynamism happening here, that these things are not stable, that they are not orthogonal, that they're pieces that are in a kind of flux, as if these were all in a kind of liquid, one of those lamps that have, when it heat up, that liquid comes up. It's if you heat this thing up and this gray stuff starts to move these pieces around. They don't look like they're in a stable location. I think over here we have also a marvelous relationship of spaces which begin to concatenate in a way which there is a progression over here of small, medium, large on either side. We have a straight connection on this side and a warped connection on this side. We have the portico in front has, in a sense, an extension out here where there's poche. The B and the A sort of bleed together. The C becomes an elongated space which takes up the rear B and A. So this is also a more mechanistic looking plan than this one, but I put them side by side because they show here is Serlio playing the same games with different geometries. And you have to notice here, an orthogonal niche that has a bit of a triangulation in a battery in it, a orthogonal niche, and then a niche that is canted off to the side, very similar to what Corbu did in La Tourette with the niches in the Canon à Lumière. And you have to notice that surely this could have been square like the rest, but Serlio is always trying to disrupt any kind of rigid orthogonality or rigid conceptual hole between the center and the edges. In other words, we now no longer have organism, but we have another kind of condition which is very hard to pin down. Very few people have been able to look at Serlio in a way that begins to understand his enormous contribution to the architects who followed. If you look at French hotel planning of the 19th century, that is 19th century in Paris, late, and I think Mike Dennis has a book on French hotels. They all have plans which are similar to this. And the whole development of French architecture in the late 19th century and English architecture comes out of this kind of thing. The English start with a central fireplace and allow the energy to bleed out in a kind of style that there is no given periphery. The French, because they're urban houses, always have a fixed perimeter, and the play occurs in an interior situation. I much prefer French 19th century planning to English 19th century planning precisely because of this, and the origin of French 19th century planning is clearly here in Serlio. We have the next, please.
On that last one,
let's go back.
Surrounded by a stair. One of the
yeah, it looks like it. I mean, you could try and draw it in three dimensions and see what it was. I mean, that's the kind of thing that one is interested in. It clearly looks like a stair, and it also is very interesting because I think it does take off and go up because there's no connection here to the rear portico. So it's clearly something that is elevated in a rather strange way. That's a good point to see. Clearly, what?
In the lower right corner, that would also be really interesting to try and draw.
This one?
No.
This guy? Yeah, what those guys are? I mean, reconstructions of these as models and drawings would be, fantastic to do a Serlio drawings of, models of the interiors and how they organize themselves would be great. Next. What's interesting here on the right is what do we have? We have an interior rotunda, but we have what would be called a double layer of poche. In other words, the poche is not just a single set of spaces, but a double set, gotten to through these ordinal axes, or cardinal axes, And then you peel off from there to go through a series of spaces and look at what this movement would be like. The oval shape, the rectangle with huge niches, an octagon, a strange oval form. And then some of these are connected to the outer layer. And you have to realize that this is madness, you know. I mean, this is a guy that doodled this stuff forever. Clearly, reality never hit him very much. But I love this sort of going from here to here, then this little dip into this guy here, which is connected into all these strange things. It's like a sort of somebody with tubes in them, a sort of a little with their legs and their arms and attached to all kinds of things. It has enormous, for me, energy about the world today. It breaks with all of the possible canonical structures. Let's go on. Not much I want to say about these. Let's just go ahead. And again, if we look at this, this has this fragile poche that is reminiscent of St. Peter's 2 or 3 of Bramante. It's like it's been shredded, and it's like a origami, that the cutout, and this is what's left of when you cut it out. This is a very interesting, because of the fragility of these connections to the corner towers, the seeming symmetry of the spaces, and the four porticos on either side and the four staircases. So this is very much like the Villa Rotunda of Palladio, in the sense that it's a four square project, and it is, in fact, if you look at the Villa Rotunda, which is the same, it is not symmetrically square, because these rooms here are in a striation this way. So there is a kind of compression of this center space about these three lines of space here, which don't occur in this direction. Here is the exterior has a bilateral symmetry, but there's only a monoaxial symmetry in this centerpiece, something that one has to notice also in the Villa Rotunda of Palladio. In other words, what makes this a critical piece, comparing its poche to a more normal poche here, comparing its center to a true biaxial symmetry. So it's important to pick up what are the critical organizational strategies when one looks at a plan. Next, please. I only show these two to show the difference between what I would call an additive octagon, which seems to be something that's built up with objects around it and objects in the center, and a subtractive octagon, which is cut out of fabric. And I think additive and subtractive are issues that go right through architecture. Is a building additive? Is it subtractive? Or is it both? Here is an additive building. Here is a subtractive building. Next. Again, one of my favorite palaces. It has an enormous forecourt, a series of the main space becomes, as it were, smaller than the four side spaces, which in a sense compress the center, and so you have these octagons on the side which compress the center into a very strange circle octagon. there's a kind of double layer of poche that you get this sense of an inner passage inside of the walls, and these strange, in a sense, compressed octagons that extend into the external periphery. So there's a compression and an extension at the same time. And compression of these spaces onto the center, and at the same time the compression here extends and thrusts, breaks through the perimeter. And I think it's important to understand this kind of dynamic condition that one finds operating in Sierra Leone. Next, please.
Peter?
Yeah.
This is one of the few drawings that you've shown that's had a section or some other two-dimensional representation or that starts to imply three dimensions. Did Sierra Leone not care about...
No, there are a lot of other drawings in the book. I only picked out plans to... in other words, I was picking out plans that begin to show critical dissonance and difference from one to the other. Okay. But there are a lot of sections in the Sierra Leone book. Next. Clearly, here we have a very strange condition. We have the two porticos here and here, and then we have a center space that in fact is just a connection, the porticos, and all of the energy is pushed to the side. So you have, as it were, two palazzi. Here is a central courtyard, here and here, with their side rooms here leading back into here, but as if the center had been cut out, which is a very different, rather than holding the thing together, then now the center is a thing that keeps things apart. So here's center pushing things to the periphery as opposed to bringing, so it's acting centrifugally rather than centripetally. And again, those forces, centrifugal and centripetal, are ways of understanding Corbu. I mean, Corbu was always working towards a centrifugal force from his stairways and ramps. And of course, Cubist painting was also working as a centrifuge, moving elements to the periphery. And so here we have an actual condition where the center space is pushing clearly to the edge. Okay, let's take a 10-minute break and we'll come back and look at Palladio. I think that that hour was for me as clear as I can be about what it means to look at a drawing and to read it, and how to interpret the kind of misreadings that were in each of these drawings. So when you pick a building, you've got to realize that there's got to be something in those plans and elevations that are going to allow you to make this kind of discourse, to make the kind of drawings that some of you made this week. Now, one of the things that I noticed just looking through is this was a tough week, and all of what I said good about last week comes crashing down this week, because clearly it was a difficult assignment. And, you know, you need to be able to see. Now, of course, we're going to look at these buildings now, and were I to have given this lecture before, you would clearly be able to do this. But since I didn't, I just wanted to see how well you would do. Some people did extraordinarily well, and some people just sort of were up swinging a bat at a virtual ball, swing it three times and sit down. I could hear the bat going around, but I wasn't sure if there was a pitcher or a catcher, or even if there was a home plate or a ball. So you all know that the difference between when you can do something and it's sort of set up for you to succeed, and things that are set up for you to have a problem. So, in fact, I was pitching curveballs this week, unlike David Wells' second curveball last night. That's the one that got smoked by the Chicago White Sox. We have a running bet up here. Neil somehow suddenly became a Chicago White Sox fan.
Yeah, for the past 24 years, because I'm from Illinois.
Anyway, he became a White Sox fan, and suddenly, I don't think the White Sox have scored 14 runs all year.
We did that three times.
Really? And that kid's never hit a home run before. I mean,
he had 16 of them over the season. Really? And he was a power hitter in Japan before he came over here.
I see. Anyway, as far as I'm concerned, the baseball season's over. Ended last Sunday.
That's a good game.
Yeah, I enjoyed it. Okay, let's look at Palladio. Now, these two churches, Redentore and San Giorgio, are in a sense what I would consider to be anomalous work of Palladio, in the sense that he did mainly urban villas in the countryside and palazzi in the cities of Vicenza and Verona. You should realize that Palladio was not allowed to build on the main body of Venice. These two churches are on a place called the Giudecca, which was called the Jewish Quarter. And so this was sort of outside of the establishment. So Palladio was seen to be a threatening architect, even though he had very important patrons, but was never allowed to build in Venice proper, as other Venetian architects like Sansovino and others were. So these two churches occur on the island of the Giudecca, very rarely are attended by tourists, because they wouldn't know Palladio from flying. Next.
Was he not allowed to build because of his architecture? Or because of
his architecture. Okay, now what we have here is a triumphal arch superimposed over a Greek temple front, very similar to San Andrea in Mantua. Only thing is, there is a distortion. Number one, there are two different orders. There is a regular scaled order, and then a giant order. And this is one of the things that Palladio deals with, is we have a giant order on giant bases, which seems in these columns to be elongated up. On one hand, there's a sense of elongation, but there's also then the sense that this thing is compressing down onto the pediment of the Greek temple front. So there are these reverse energies. There's the lifting up and the compressing down, the giant order and the ordinary scale order. And you can only realize how giant an order it is when you look at the scale figures here and what a normal base would be to notice the base of these columns.
In one of the readings, they said that the bases were possibly not his decision, or did I misunderstand that?
Maybe not.
Okay.
I'm making sure. I mean, We're looking at the artifacts, right?
Right, I know.
Well, who made the decision?
All right, I got it.
Whether he had a cold or not. Okay? All right?
All right.
Okay? Remember?
Yeah.
Yeah, keep your eye on the ball. Okay? But you could research that if you want. I mean, that could be a nice term paper, whether those decisions for the bases were his or not. All right? They're too often repeated in the loggia in Vicenza, the giant order that was never completed. Now, maybe those bases were not his either, but this thematic of a giant order and a minor order is too much part of what Palladio was interested in, that is, the play of scales, to suggest that, you know, it was him or was it Scamozzi? Who knows, right? The body of the church is important to notice, and again we get this sense of elongation, the elongation of a double, as it were, apse. Here is an apse with columns, and these columns are pressed together here and wide over here, and then a second apse, so we have a double apse-ended church, which is unique. And then we have the sense of compression, because as this is extended, there is the sense of compression on the side aisles and the main body of church, the transepts here. So this is a very strange sense of elongation and compression that occurs in the plan as well. So we have elongation and compression on the facade, and elongation and compression on the interior. Next. This is two different drawings of Redentori, and what's interesting about these drawings, this is from Palladio, a book closely following Palladio's drawing. It's not Palladio's drawing. And this is Scamozzi's drawing. And what's interesting is you get a completely different sense of the proportion of these columns here and the columns over here because of the shading and shadowing that Scamozzi did. So there are different editions of the works of Palladio that draw these artifacts in a different way. Next, please. And you can find different drawings of the church. Here, a drawing with the poche or the columns black, and here with the poche as merely outline and white. And of course, again, the really important thing, I mean, we've now noticed so many times the strange crossing column poches that relate them to the wall this way, to the poche this way and across, but the double apse end with a kind of Saint-Chapelle like chapel here, a little Gothic chapel on to a second apse. So we get the transept, we get the perimeter bays here, and then this very strange condition, which makes this thing very important. Next. And of course, you have to realize that Palladio did measured drawings of Roman ruins. A lot of what his interest is was to play with those artifacts and relate what he was doing. This is one of the Roman baths. And then what I did was to take and superpose the proportions and scale of the Roman bath onto Palladio's project, showing using the crossing bays as the determinant. And you begin to see how interestingly, closely related, especially the relationship of this, the transept half round condition to the bath. So there's no question that this was the model from which Palladio created the central part of the church.
Was there any specific reason for choosing the bath? It seems like an odd choice for a church, maybe based on a Roman bath, given the sort of undertones of what goes on in the Roman bath.
Well, what about the Greek temple front, which was a pagan icon?
Well, it just seems like this is even a little bit more farther than the temple.
Maybe that's why they didn't let him build in Venice. I never even thought of that, by the way. Never crossed my mind. I'm only interested in looking. I mean, I don't care what they did in here and what they did in here. I mean, it's really unimportant to what I want you to do. Right? And I just want you to don't get crazy now and say, oh my God, Roman baths, Catholic churches, doesn't go. Right? Just look at the objects. Okay? And there is a correlation that you need to look at. Okay. Next. And of course, you can begin to play with the geometries, regular geometries, of and you can put them in various places. I mean, you can say that the geometry of a square works at this point and comes across the poche here, and then you see these particular half round as pressed in from this square, or you can take the square as the edge of the transept bays, and then you see the conditions of things pushed out. This is where one begins to get into an analytic mode to understand what these artifacts are, where there are distortions from an ideal condition. If we took the square, and clearly the square here is very important, but you extend the axes out using this square, and you can get this particular square where these pieces fall out, or you can get this particular square where these pieces fall in. So it just depends how far you take the square out. Next. And then, of course, you can get a square here, which suggests that this is pushing out and a pushing in. And you can read squares overlay. You get a square here that and a square overlapped here that comes through this particular line here as the overlay. In other words, there's a kind of centric line of these double squares which occurs on this line of the edge of the poche, which shows then that the transepts are in fact off of this double square overlay, which I think is interesting. And one can do continual analyses of these buildings. I myself have done over 800 drawings of Palladio, doing this kind of, to see the dynamic relationship of these parts to Cartesian geometry and how far they move off of this, how unstable, even though they always have some form of symmetry, how off of symmetry they are. Palladio, unlike Serlio, rarely uses figural means for his dislocation. He merely takes conventional classical elements and puts them in different proportional, either extensive, compressive, giant order relationships. He doesn't use figuration. He uses the conventional pieces in a non-conventional way. Next, please. And again, a reading of this particular piece as a square, and therefore you get the extension out here and the compression in from here. Reading the central organization as a series of five squares. Now notice this, because the center here of that organization occurs over here, whereas the center of the other one occurred down here, and these two centers frame that center so that there are two organizational geometries that give you two different centers which, when placed together, frame the transept arcs, which I think is very interesting, that that all of this can be framed and you produce that line there, and remember the double square overlay which produced this line down here, which gives a symmetry about there. Or you could merely say, here are the five bays, and the symmetry here is in an asymmetrical place. Any way you want to interpret. Next. And again, drawings that show the relationship of the poche to the center, the sort of gasket spaces pushing out from this extension of this organization in both directions. Next. Next. This is what I would consider, if one were doing a term paper, an appropriate analysis. Where you looked at all the possible relationships that could accrue. Next. Some of these give you information, some don't. Next. Two different sections, Bertaldi Scamozzi's drawing and another close to Palladio. Next. And then a beginning analysis of the sectional relationships. Again, look at the play in the double apse of this particular apsoidal piece has a relationship to the crossing, whereas this apsoidal piece has a smaller scale, so you have the medium scale, the giant scale, and then this third scale, which is in the second apse, second apse, the chapel-like apse. Next. And, of course, you can take the Arch of Titus and put it over, and you clearly, the Arch of Titus is practically spot on to this central organization. And you see the compression on the pediment of the arch. Next. And you begin to see also, you can look at this as a classical villa organization with the ABCBA relationship and how the church organizes itself spatially in this kind of sequence. Next. Next. Wait, yeah, that's, keep going. Okay. That slides out of line. Okay. Here's Ray Dottori. I told you the story of sending the architectural critic Jeff Kipnis, who will be here for juries, a at the end of the semester, usually comes here for juries, who teaches at Ohio State and at Columbia. I sent him to see Ray Dottori, and he stood, got off the Vaporetto, I guess, over here, and came in front of the piazza and looked at this thing and asked somebody where Ray Dottori was, because he didn't see anything. And then when he was told it was Ray Dottori, he confessed that it was impossible for him to read this. And that's what's interesting. Even somebody who was not trained as an architect, but a training in architectural theory and history and criticism, has trouble reading these kinds of artifacts. These kinds of readings that we're doing are for architects. And why architectural critics have a problem seeing is they don't see as you all see. And all of the things you're doing here at Yale are building up a way of seeing as an architect, which is not the way you were raised. Next. These are two drawings of the sections of Ray Dottori by Bertotti Scamozzi. Next. And of course, then you get this strange concatenation of a what looks to be four pediments, all right, concatenated over one another. You have this particular pediment here, which this pediment sits on. Then you have an echo of this pediment back here, by the way, and an echo, a further echo of this pediment back here. So you have this piling up of pediments and a smaller pediment in here set inside of this pediment. So you have, in actuality, five pediments. And of course, this is not, this is a half round, but appears to be pediment-like on in the organization. Again, we have a giant order, which is both elongated and compressive. But not only that, we have this sort of Russian doll-like situation of a pediment and a pediment, right? A pediment and another one behind, which is totally strange. You will never find another church in Christendom that has this kind of five-pediment organization. Next. And then you can compare it, as I did, to the organization of the pediments in the Pantheon in Rome, and clearly the proportion and dimensions of the Pantheon and its portico and its overall dimension have something to do with the organization of the scale and dimension of the pediments and porticos of Ray Dottori. Next. Again, this comparison to the Pantheon. Next. And again, calling out the different columnar relationships, which we will talk about next week when we look at Rinaldi and the kind of play between framing conditions and then, in other words, paired columns and then single columns framing an opening and then paired columns, and then some anarchic end column, which clearly this column relates to this column over here. These two relate to each other and these over here, but then this one relates over here. So there's this concatenation across the facade with the columnar relationships, which I think are important. And of course, the comparison between the half round columns and the square columns, which is important, or rectilinear columns, and the fact that this column has a round base, and this column has a round base, and a round column, and this is a square column, and they're part of the same organization, which is something you need to look at. Next.
Are these types of drawings overlaid on top of existing drawings?
Yeah.
All right. I mean, are those all right for us to do for future assignments?
Yeah. Next. Now, here we have the plan of Redentore, which I think is, again, an amazing plan. We have, this time, the transept half rounds instead of external within the frame of the church, so the figural frame is within. And then we have, again, a double apse, but a different organization. We have a series of columns which frame another half round within a second transept. So we have, which is traditional in North German Gothic churches, this double transept. Here we have the half round and the rectilinear transept. And it's as if this looks like a scabbard in a sheath, that this is, as it were, a scabbard sticking in to this particular vessel. And it has all kinds of anthropomorphic allusions in it. It's an extraordinary plan. I think it has much more energy for me because of this strange double transept and double apse. And then you look where the crossing, the altar is kind of, it's hard to find, you know, it seems to exist on a line between this crossing and this crossing, and these extensions back here are to me, you know, quite extraordinary as a plan. Again, why is it extraordinary when compared to a Gothic cathedral or a Renaissance plan, either a Greek cross or a Roman cross plan? The San Giorgio and Redentore are aberrant proposals. Next, please. And then you can begin to do the same kind of analysis of the squares. There's a square here, starting from there. There's a square here from the front. You can overlap both of those squares, and you get a central square, which, as you see, is not on this line of articulation, but falls off it. So there's always a dislocation from any kind of classical or Platonic or Cartesian ordination. In other words, the geometry looks like it is syncopated and related in a way, but then when you realize that it falls off, you begin to see how truly problematic this church is. Of course, this drawing over here shows the relationship lining up the two transepts, the relationship between a kind of compression that exists in Redentore and an extension and elongation that exists in San Giorgio. And what's interesting is San Giorgio extends out this way. Redentore is compressed this way but extends out past San Giorgio. So you have compression on the nave in Redentore and extension at the narthex, and you have extension out in San Giorgio, extension here, and then compression, as shown by these arrows, on the nave itself. Yeah.
What would lead one to not think that in Giorgio that the transept is being compressed in between the rectangle and the spaces above the transept, that it's like a being squashed like a grape?
It is being squashed. I would agree. I said
so. So you could see compression in both
and extension. Yes.
Okay.
Right.
Okay.
Yeah. No, I said originally that the nave and the transept, you get the compression of both extension and compression in San Giorgio, which gives you this extension out, the compression, and it has to push itself out. Whereas the compression here is almost contained. I mean, the half round transept ends are almost contained within the vessel, whereas these are clearly out. Next, please. And again, looking for kind of conventional geometry. And of course, there's several kinds of geometry you can work on these things. There's Cartesian, there's Fibonacci series, there are all kinds of geometric proportions that one could look to organize these particular objects. Next. And again, here you can get the double square which falls on the center of the... So these appropriately organize themselves as a double shifted square. But again, when you try it over here of a double square, you find the center line nowhere and the end point nowhere. Next. So all of these drawings that we made were probes to try and understand what was actually happening in terms of a regular geometry in these projects. Next. And again, playing with the circular and the half round and the square and how they organize themselves. Next. And the striation across. I mean, this is clearly very heavily striated with these kind of dog bone shapes that make up the nave. And the same up here. These two gasket spaces here, so you have the main chapels and the gaskets between gasket, chapel, gasket, chapel, gasket, chapel, gasket. And then a series of further gasket, chapel, gasket, which is again one of the signature elements of Palladio, this series of gasket spaces, the interstitial spaces, which are like void poche. Next, an analysis of, you know, very small scale elements. Next. Next. Very interesting, by the way, the interstitial walkway between the poche, very similar to Brunelleschi's Duomo walk, the sort of space between the two shells. Here we have this walkway between the double poche. Next. Looking at the outer shell. Next. And again, an analysis which breaks this down into a classical villa party. Next, I think that. And how you can read both compressions and extensions in relationship, depending how you want to read these pieces? Next, that's it. Okay, let's go next door and look at drawings.